My name is Leanne, and I'm an alcoholic. I'd like to welcome everyone to Simple Actions. My name is Leanne, and I'm an alcoholic. We have a little different format tonight. We normally meet here on Monday nights at 7 o'clock. It's a big book study. This weekend, we've got a walk through the steps with Bob and Valerie. So we're going to go ahead and get this started. If you'll help me with opening with the Serenity Prayer. God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. The Simple Actions Group wishes to extend a warm welcome to all in attendance this evening. These premises are non-smoking. Our group is welcome to use this room and the restrooms that are across the hall and up a small flight of stairs. At this time, please silence your cell phones. Also, we respectfully ask that those present please refrain from unnecessary moving around the room. This will keep distractions and disturbances to a minimum and allow everyone to listen uninterrupted. Tonight, the coffee will be served at the break around 7:45. To respect the speakers, we're going to ask that you remain seated, and we'll bring out lots of coffee at the break about 7:45. This group practices the spiritual foundations of anonymity, singleness of purpose, and effective sponsorship. As a group, we believe that Alcoholics Anonymous provides alcoholics with a set of clear directions on precisely how to recover from the illness of alcoholism on the basis of simple actions. These actions are contained in the book Alcoholics Anonymous. It is the purpose of this meeting to carry that clear message and to focus on precisely how to recover from the illness of alcoholism on the basis of AA simple actions. The AA preamble. Alcoholics Anonymous is a fellowship of men and women who share their experience, strength, and hope with each other. They may solve their common problem and help others to recover from alcoholism. The only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking. There are no dues or fees for AA membership. We are self-supporting through our own contributions. AA is not allied with any sect, denomination, politics, organization, or institution. Does not wish to engage in any controversy, neither endorses nor opposes any causes. Our primary purpose is to stay sober and help other alcoholics to achieve sobriety. And we're really grateful for this experience this weekend. Tonight, we're going to start off with Bob, and we're really glad to have him back tonight. He was here 2 years ago for one of our annual conferences for a weekend, and we're really glad to have him and Valerie. Valerie was here last year, and tonight's session, the first session, will be lack of power. And so tonight I want to start off and just find out, are there anyone in the room who's within their first 30 days that would like to introduce themselves by their first name, just so we can welcome you and get to know you? Just raise your hand.
I'm James.
Hey, James. Welcome. Hey, Karen.
Back.
Hey, Gina. Welcome. Hey, Garrett.
Welcome.
Welcome. Hey, Randall. Welcome. Hey, Dwayne. Welcome. Hey, Desiree. Welcome.
Anybody else back here?
I'm
Hi, Kelly. Welcome. Yes. Hey, Sheila, welcome. Anyone else? Yes.
Hey, Chris.
Hey, Chris, welcome. Hey, Matt, welcome. Hey, Kyle, welcome. All right. We're really glad y'all are all here. You're in for a big treat tonight. And so with without further ado, I'm going to go ahead and ask Bob to come on up and get us started tonight on Lack of Power.
My name is Bob Darrell, and I am alcoholic.
Amen.
And it is only through the grace of a God that I was afraid to believe in, and I've accessed and maintained in my life, through a process outlined in a book called Alcoholics Anonymous, the ability to remain reasonably sponsorable, and a persistent, consistent effort in the primary purpose of forgetting myself and trying to help other drunks, and consequently I haven't had a drink or any mind or emotional altering medication since October 31st, 1978. Yeah, wow, I know. Sometimes I can't believe it. How this happened. I'm the guy who relapsed for a half dozen years. I'm the guy who time and time and time again, I just hit these horrendous, disgusting, humiliating, horrifying bottoms, and I swear to myself I'm never touching any of that stuff again. A couple months or a couple weeks later, I'm back at it again. So for me to stand here and not be depressed and be reasonably happy sober is, it's big doings here for me. I want to welcome the people that are new. Step one is the hardest thing a guy like me ever has to do. Step one is so hard that I think it kills most of us. You know, it's just, there's this uncanny resistance in me to facing this piece of truth about me. In the beginning of chapter 3, it says that most of us have been unwilling to admit we were real alcoholics. I've traveled all over the world, probably 50 different countries. I've been to meetings everywhere you can think of, from Russia to China, I mean, just all over. And the universal thing about alcoholics is we don't want to be alcoholics. I mean, we really don't. We'll be, I mean, and I didn't want to be an alcoholic. I had family members that were alcoholics. They were pathetic. I am not like that. I'd rather be a drug addict than an alcoholic. There's a little panache in drug addiction. There's rock stars that are drug addicts, for God's sake. There's nobody that wet their pants I ever looked up to. I don't want to be an alcoholic. I'll be a mental health case. If you're a mental health case, you get pills and sympathy. That's not all bad. I mean, I'll be a mental health case. I like pills and I like a little sympathy. I remember going to a bar with a diagnosis of clinically depressed. You know, people will buy you a drink for that. If you told them the real truth, that you're full of self-pity, nobody buys you a drink for self-pity, but they'll buy you a drink for clinical depression. I know, I've been there. I don't want to be an alcoholic. And you know something, it doesn't matter. People who argue with the truth get sick. And nobody argues with the reality of who they are more than an alcoholic. It's not denial. That's a treatment. That started coming around here in the 70s. It's not denial. This is worse. If it was denial, it'd be manageable. This is self-delusion. It's psychotic wishful thinking. It's all the evidence is I'm alcoholic, but my God, I don't want to be an alcoholic. And I start up, and I start imagining I'm not an alcoholic, and then I'll play the game of bet your life that I'm not, and I'll take a drink, and oops. And what? Why is that? Why don't I want to be an alcoholic? Well, I don't want to be. If you're an alcoholic, then I'm going to have to do something here, and I don't want to do nothing. I just want relief. I don't want to change. I don't want anybody butting into my business. I don't want anybody telling me what to do. I just want relief. Thank you. And one of the part of the problem with me is that I don't know what it is to be an alcoholic, and all my perception keeps telling me I'm not. I thought that an alcoholic was someone who lived on the streets and, you know, had snot-slicked back hair and yellow tennis shoes, and, you know, they have a a trench coat with five different garments on that are all dirty and matted underneath. And I'm not that. Oh my God, I went to my first treatment center. I wasn't even old enough to take a legal drink. I was probably 19 or 20. You could have put me on a lie detector and said, Bob, is there any way in the world you could possibly be alcoholic? And I would have said, absolutely not. I'm going through my better living through chemistry phase of my alcoholism. Now, I'd admit to being a drug addict. I mean, that's okay. I can, but I'm not an alcoholic. Treatment centers ask you weird questions like, what's your drug of choice? Huh. I think the only answer I can think of is, what do you got? I mean, that's not the right question. The right question should be, what happens to you when you drink alcohol? Yeah, I know you're a heroin addict. I understand. But what happens to you when you drink alcohol? Are you alcoholic? I didn't want to be an alcoholic. And people in these treatment centers and in meetings, people would talk about, if you're an alcoholic, you have an allergic reaction to alcohol. No, I don't. Well, what is the allergic reaction? Well, you know what they say. They say you have this, you drink alcohol and you develop a phenomenon of craving. No, I don't. I get drunk and I'm in trouble. Yeah, but all the guys I hang out with drink like that. I'm not alcoholic. Oddly enough, they're all alcoholic, but I don't know that. I can't see a phenomenon of craving. And the insidious part of this sickness, and it's why most of us die of this disease, it's the only illness I know of that will use your own mind against you. So you can never really see the picture. The whole rest of the world can know you're an alcoholic, but you don't. You don't want to see it. And I heard these people talk about this phenomenon of craving. I don't get it. It's funny. I spent 7-8 years in therapy with some of the greatest psychiatrists on the planet. Because my mother was a therapist and my dad was politically connected, they got me in to see people that you had to be a freaking movie star to see these guys. And I never found out who I was. I come to Alcoholics Anonymous and I hear people that don't even have doctorate degrees in nothing talking about themselves, and you introduced me to me. And I found myself in your experience. And one of the first awakenings I ever had in Alcoholics Anonymous, I was sitting in a meeting. This is probably in the mid-70s, early 70s, I guess, early to mid-70s. And I'm listening to a woman talk about her experience at a dinner party. And all of a sudden, I remembered something that had happened to me when I was 18 years old. Now, when I was 18 years old, I marched under the flag of sex, drugs, and rock and roll. It was mostly sex and drugs because we were, and a little bit of rock and roll once in a while, but that was our flag. And so I'm not an alcoholic, and I'm dating this girl, and she invites me to her family's house for dinner. She wants me to meet her parents. And I go, and I don't like stuff like that. I've always been a little self-conscious, you know, when you feel like people are looking at me anyway, you know. But I go, and we sit down at the dinner table. These are nice people. And they bring out a bottle of wine. Now, this is not the kind of bottle of wine I would have bought. This was a little wimpy, nothing Al-Anon bottle of wine. You know what I mean? I mean, I don't even think it was 12% alcohol. It was not even a Blue Nun or something like that. You know, they bring out this bottle of wine and they pour us all a glass. Now, I'm not an alcoholic. My deal is drugs, so I think. And they pour me this glass of wine, and I drink it. And I drink it quickly. I don't know why I drink quickly. I guess evaporation is a childhood issue with me or something. I don't know. But I drink quickly. And I've killed two glasses out of that bottle of wine. They're still sipping on the first glass, and the bottle's dead. And I'm sitting there. I don't know nothing about alcoholism, phenomena, craving, none of that stuff. I got two glasses of wine in me. And the conversation at the dinner table that had earlier been okay is starting to become tedious and stupid. Now, I don't say anything that it's irritating me, but I just sit there and I just, all of it, I just antsy. I finally said to him, I said, "God, that was good wine. Do you have any more?" They said no, and they went back to talking about sports and Vietnam and movies and stuff, and I'm sitting there with two glasses of wine in me, and I think I'm losing my mind. And I finally blurted out, "You know, I like beer." And they said, "Well, we don't have the beer, Bob. The next time you come over, we'll get you a six-pack of beer." And they went back to talking, and I'm sitting there, and I'm spinning in my head. I'm just irritated. I'm just... Finally excused myself, went to their bathroom, locked the door, and then like a crazy guy, I went through their cabinets. And I found an unopened bottle of cough medicine that was about 25-30% alcohol, something like that, with codeine and turpentine hydrate, which is a bonus. And I sat there on the edge of that bathtub and I chugged that bottle of cough medicine, and that spinning in my head just went. And I was able to sit there and focus and think straight. And came up with a little plan. I went back out to that dinner table and I told him the story about something I'd forgotten about that I had to take care of, and I was so sorry to leave, but I had to, and they were very nice about it, and I went and I got in my car, which was parked on their street in front of their house, and I drove down their street 20-25 miles an hour like you're supposed to, turned the corner, got out of sight, and drove like an insane guy, probably 70-80 miles an hour, to my friend Brett's house, because Brett had a bar in his basement and a bunch of Thai stick. And man, I couldn't get there quick enough. And I was the only person at that dinner table that had alcoholism. If those other people had alcoholism, we'd all been in the bathroom looking through the cabinets, right? We'd all been on our way to Brett's house or a liquor store or somewhere. Because alcoholism, if you have it and you drink alcohol, it sets something off. You know, it's funny how... you don't see it. You don't see it. You know, all the years I've had that reaction when I start, I never seem to stop. I don't know that that is the reaction to alcohol, because it uses my own mind against me. What it seems like to me is that, okay, I've been in trouble from drinking, and in the last three times I drank, I got too drunk. The one time I went and got drugs and almost got busted. I can't do that anymore. I'm going to have just a couple to take the edge off. I think three is safe. Three seems safe. Three seems... I never punched a cop on three. I never blew... three drinks, you still got most of your paycheck. I mean, three drinks seems like a good idea. Three's good. And then about halfway through the third drink, it'll become very apparent to me that three was a bad number. I mean, no, I don't know that that's an allergic reaction to the effect of the alcohol. I think I'm just changing my mind. Do you know, I never, in all the years I partied, never was in a guy's basement smoking dope, drinking wine, been in a bar like I used to hang out with my buddies, doing lines, doing shots and beers, shooting pool, been getting partying for about an hour, and have one of my buddies say, "Hey, Bob, let me buy you another drink." I've never known the experience of standing there and thinking to myself, "No, I'm good, thanks." Never once. I can't. Now, if the heat's on me and you're watching me and I'm in trouble, I may cut it off and then get out of there and get some more later somewhere else. But I've never felt satisfied. And if you can't get enough, you're compelled to get too much. And every time I ever took a drink of alcohol, regardless of my drug of choice, regardless of what other things I was into, every drink of alcohol, as the effect of it hit me, I would break out in this irresistible yearning for more. Do you know that that reaction only occurs in people with chronic alcoholism? It doesn't occur in anyone else. Doesn't occur. I have friends that came back from Vietnam with mega heroin habits because the China White was so cheap down there. Do you know some of those guys, 35 years later, can have two or three beers and go home? And then some of those guys are like me, and they have two or three beers, and they don't know where they're going to end up, but they can't stop. They may go get drugs, they may go get more alcohol, they don't know where they're going to go, but they're going. If you're an alcoholic and you have a drink of alcohol, it's like having sex with a gorilla. You ain't done till the gorilla's done. You know, you can tell yourself all night long, me and that gorilla are just going to have a dance. No, you're not. I'm telling you, it's bad. Don't pet the gorilla. Don't pet the gorilla. The insanity is the insanity is when I start having thoughts like, but the gorilla's so lonely. Don't pet the gorilla. So I finally get this. Now it's a combination of being exposed to the truth through your experience in AA, coupled with my own failure at trying to control and enjoy my drinking. And I tried and I failed and I tried and I failed. And there's a test in the big book. Some of you might be sitting here and you might be thinking, well, I don't know. I think my problem's speed. My problem's cocaine. My problem's Oxycontin. I don't know if I got that alcoholism thing. I think I just went a little too far with the pills. I think that's really the problem. You want to find out if you're an alcoholic? Chapter 3 has a test. It says you can quickly diagnose yourself. Go over to the nearest bar room and try some controlled drinking. Try to drink and then stop abruptly. So if you're like me, the book says you got to do this more than once. You got to do it a few times for it to get some little traction to find out if you're an alcoholic. But if you have my mind, the mind that is kind of against you, it's a hard test to take. Because if I go, okay, let's say I don't think I'm an alcoholic. I'm going to go in this bar. I think these AA people are wrong. I think I could have two and walk away. Okay, I'm going to go in and have two. Now you can't smoke nothing, take nothing, two drinks, that's it. And okay, I'm going to go in there and I'm going to have the two drinks. And since I'm only going to have two, I'll have doubles. Well, no, I mean, you know, I mean, wouldn't you? I would, wouldn't you? I'm going to have to, if you're going to have two, I'll have two doubles. 100-proof doubles, two. About halfway through the second drink, it's going to become very clear to me that this is a bad test day. Because I didn't know that game was on. That game's on. I got to have a drink. I got to have another drink. Watch that game. Some girl would walk in. I'd look at her and go, oh my God. That's her. Got to have a drink with her. Joe would come in. Joe's always got something good to smoke. I got to have a drink with Joe. Bad test day. Tomorrow would be a better test day. And tomorrow, what happens is halfway as the effect of the alcohol starts to hit me, it's like all my powers of justification and rationalization will line up with whatever is necessary for me to address and satisfy a craving that I'm not even conscious of. For years, this allergic reaction to alcohol punked me out and pushed me to burn my life to the ground over and over and over and over again. And I don't know what's wrong. I think I'm morally weak. I think I have mental illness. I think all kinds of stuff. I never understood that I had alcoholism. Well, I finally get it. I finally get that I'm the guy. I can't take the first drink. I like a lot of alcoholics are very self-centered and egocentric. And if you're egocentric, my ego fancies that knowledge is power. So I think with the knowledge that I can't take the first drink and no drugs, no nothing, I can't take nothing, I think that coupled with my sincere desire to change my life and become different and never touch that stuff, I think I'm out of the woods. I think, okay, this is good, I know now. And little did I know that I was about to enter into the most horrific, demoralizing years of my life. A phase of my alcoholism, which late stage alcoholism eventually took me to trying to kill myself, take my own life in 1978. I didn't understand what was happening to me. How could, I mean, I'm not stupid. I even went to work in the field. I became an alcoholism counselor because I think knowledge is power. I was a great counselor up until the day I lost the job for being drunk on the job. I mean, the treatment center don't like that much. Knowledge is not power. I'll tell you what knowledge is. It's fodder for the ego. It's stuff that the ego uses to puff itself up and give itself an illusion of power. But there is no knowledge. There is no power in knowledge. And I, in those years, I couldn't understand what was happening to me. And I would swear to myself time and time again and mean it, man, I can't do this to myself. I can't do this. In no time at all, I'm a homeless guy. I'm in and out of treatment centers and halfway houses and missions and Salvation Armies. And I'm the guy that was accepted to Ivy League colleges. I was the guy that came from an amazing family with tremendous opportunity. I tell you, you never know how close you are to being homeless until the day comes that the people that are propping you up pull their support away, and you'll slide down there so quick, it'll make your head spin. And here I am. How does this happen to me? And I'm swearing I'll never touch that stuff again. I keep going back to it. Dr. Silkworth, in the doctor's opinion, starts to shed a little bit of light on what happens to me when I get sober. And Silky says, he says that when guys like me get sober, something happens to me. And he says that the symptoms are three things. He said, I become restless. You know what that is. It's that, you know, you're sober a while and it's just, What's wrong, Bob? Beats the crap out of me, I don't know. Can't get settled anywhere, you know? I just can't get comfortable, really. I just bear up under it, but it's just this low-level restlessness. And he says the second symptom is irritable. Well, I'm not irritable. Irritable people irritate the crap out of me. I'm not irritable. What I am is a guy who, when I quit drinking and the fog lifts, I can't help it, but for God's sakes, I just see how stupid people are. I mean, it's a gift. I can't help it. Everywhere I look, I see stupid people. Oh my God, stupid people in traffic, the people I work with, oh my God, they're all idiots. The people in the grocery store, you go to AA meetings, they got the stupid people grouped right here. Oh my God, I remember sitting there just, and AA was intellectually offensive to me. I'd sit here and, God, you just, first things first, easy. I felt like I was being stoned to death by refrigerator magnets from a recovery bookstore. You know, these cliches. Like, doesn't anybody speak English? God, the people here are so stupid. Oh, and then Jerry, oh, this is driving me nuts. I, on a day, I'm new again. Again. I don't like myself. I just want to crawl under a rock somewhere. And somebody in AA comes up to you and they go, has anybody told you today they love you? I don't know what the answer is to that question. So I tell them the truth. No. And they go, I do. And they give you a big bear hug. And I'm just, my cells are screaming, don't touch me. Leave me alone. Jesus. You're grateful for everything. I'm not grateful for anything. I don't even like me. I hate me. I mean, you'd hate me. How could I not hate me? If someone else would have done to my loved ones what I did to them, I'd want to kill them. So is it any wonder that we secretly end up hating ourselves? You're grateful for everything. People are stupid, nay. All this God stuff. Stop it. And I'm chronically malcontent. The third symptom. And this is a baffling thing. Because secretly, every time I get sober, I've got this big vacancy inside of me. I can't put my finger on it. I can't even understand it, but there's just something ain't right. There's something that's missing. And it drives at me like a stone in my shoe. I can't get rid of it. And I've got a mind that's obsessed with trying to wrest some happiness and satisfaction out of life. So I'm always targeting things under the delusion that if I could acquire the right things in my life the right way, surely then I would be happy and satisfied. And I will look around. I see what happy. I see somebody looks happy. What do they have? Well, they have a girl that looks like that. Okay. They got a job that pays like that. Okay. Did an angel get its wings? And so, and what happens is like I work like hell. I go after that stuff, and whatever I acquire and bring into my life, no matter how good it seems in the acquisition, I'll tell you something: the shine wears off of it very quickly for me. So I live a life of desperate and futile desperation. A life I get sober, and it's like, oh yeah, oh, come here, baby. Yeah, yeah. No, I was wrong about her. Oh, that job in the steel mill, oh man, this job. No. Stupid people at work there. The shine wears off of everything. And I don't understand that it is absolutely impossible to fill an inside vacancy with outside stuff, but my head won't let me see that. So I think I'm going to make myself whole and complete by acquisition, when in actuality we move towards completeness by subtraction, by jettisoning and letting go and getting rid of. And I don't know that, because that doesn't make sense to me. So here I am, I'm sober time and time again. I'm restless, I'm irritable, I'm discontent. I'm a worrier. I wake up in the morning worrying about all kinds. I have a mind that from the moment I obtain consciousness in the morning, it starts presenting possible threat assessments to me. You know what I mean? It's all it does. It does threat assessments all the time. So I live in my head having conversations with people that aren't in the room just in case I encounter them all the time. I'm just, oh God, I'm always solving problems that haven't occurred yet. Always trying to clear up the wreckage of my future. I'm just always living up here in the control center. And it just wears on me. It's like being stuck in a very small space with about 8 ADD kids that have overdosed on sugar and none of them like you. It's just, my head wears me out. By the end of the day, I go to an 8 o'clock meeting because I'm just nuts and I don't know what else to do. And somebody will say, how you doing, Bob? I'll just go, I'm hanging in there. I'm wearing myself out from the inside. And so what happens is that wear, all of that wears on me, and the waves of remorse as I start to occasionally, intermittently think of the things I did to my mother and father and some of the women I loved, and the remorse, it washes over me. And it grinds away my resolve to never pick up a drink, because there comes a time in me when my emotions yearn for relief so desperately that the intellectual knowledge that to pick up a drink is to destroy myself is meaningless. It's meaningless. And I go back to it. And I don't do that once or twice. I do that time and time and time again. And I'll tell you what happened to me at the last couple of years. You know, I used to get sober, and I'd get sober and I'd get hope. I'd get hope that I'm going to turn things around. I'd get hope. So I'd go get a good job, and I'd hook up with some girl, and I'd start trying to put my life back together again. Because I'm a hopeful person. I didn't know that when it comes to alcoholism, hope is deadly. But I'm hopeful. And then what happens? A couple months later, I burn my life to the ground. I'll tell you something. If you're like me and you do that time and time again, eventually you stop getting back up. Why should I build it up again? What's the point? Why should I go get a good job? Why should I hook up? What's the point? Because I'm going to hate myself and everything's going to be gone in about 6 months anyway. What's the point of getting back up? Now that is moving into the arena of an alcoholic of the hopeless variety. And it's more than just a hope of putting your life together. It's all, the worst, the last piece of that hopeless variety alcoholic was when I started to understand that even though I've burnt my life to the ground and I can't even get back up again, and I hate myself, and I loathe everything about me and everything I've become, and my emotions are just awful. And now, when I need the relief from alcohol the most, I can't even get it. That was the worst thing that alcoholism ever did to me, was at the end of my drinking, I would drink in futility. I would drink hoping to jumpstart a party that just don't jumpstart no more. The last couple years of my drinking, I'm not the guy that's in the band. I'm not the guy shooting pool with my buddies. I'm not the guy hooking up with girls. I'm not the guy laughing in the bars and the parties. I'm not that guy anymore. I'm the guy who drinks in depression and self-pity. I'm the guy who drinks in this horrid, horrid loneliness that will drive me sometimes at 3 or 4 in the morning to call up people I went to grade school with. or call up ex-girlfriends and cry into the phone, "We should have got married," until our husband gets on the phone and threatens me. At the end of my drinking, I don't bathe. Because I don't care. I become an oblivion drinker. The whole point is to get as much of that medicine in me as quickly as possible, just to blot me out. Now, in our book, it talks about, we have at the very end, we have the two alternatives. One is to go on to the bitter end, blotting out the consciousness of our intolerable situation as best we can. That's door number one. And door number two, or accept spiritual help. Let's do door number one. Here's the problem with door number one. I'm in for door number one. I think it's a good door. Except you can't stay blotted out 24/7. The worst thing about alcoholism is you're forced intermittently into consciousness. And there you are. And there you are in the presence of the person you secretly hate the most. You're in the presence of the person that stuck it to you and let you down over and over and over and over again. If I could have blotted it out and stayed out of it, until it killed me, I'm in. I'm signing up for that. I ended up trying to kill myself in 1978. Because I've been trying to drink myself to death, but oh my God. I bet you I'm not the only hope to die drunk in this room. The problem is it takes a long time. It's like being kicked to death by rabbits. It just goes on and on and on. I mean, oh my God, by the time you finally are dead, you've wished you were dead for years. By the time it finally kills you, everybody you loved hates you. They hate you, they despise you. I run into a guy on the streets of Las Vegas every once in a while. He's about 40-some years, probably 40, 42 years old. His dad was a good man. His dad and I were in detox together in 1978. His dad never stayed sober. And it only took a couple more years of breaking his son's heart and disappointing his son. When his dad finally drank himself to death, 30 years later, if you run into his son and he remembers who you are, he'll go on a tirade of venom about how much he hates his father. His dad's been dead for 30 years and he still hates his father. And I knew, I'll tell you, Bill and I were close. Bill loved his son. Bill would have done anything for his son. See, that's what alcoholism does to us, doesn't it? It wouldn't be so bad if it just killed me, but what it does, it just permanently wounds the people that we love. And they're never quite the same. They're never quite the same. It's a horrible disease. And yet, in the hands of this program recovery, it turns out to be a blessing. You know, they say that every practicing alcoholic negatively impacts a minimum of 10 people. I think that's a low estimate, actually. I mean, every employer I ever had got hurt by me somehow. Every relationship I was ever in, they walked away feeling emotionally hurt and battered. My family, I mean, no one ever had a good experience. No one ever came away from being involved with me in the latter days of my drinking and said, I'm so glad Bob was in my life. Nobody ever said that. There was, nobody. And I think members of Alcoholics Anonymous who come into AA and buy the whole package, I mean the whole package, the actions of respect for the fellowship and then ultimately for your family and for your employer. You start to practice these principles in all your affairs and you spend the money and the time and the effort to go and seek out the people and make amends to them. There's not a person you will make amends to that's not positively affected by that. And then you spend the rest of your life trying to help people just like you. How many people do we pop out? Does a member of Alcoholics Anonymous who's all in, I mean all in, how many people do we affect positively? 100? Probably minimal. And then the people I make amends to, they have a change of heart because they've been jaded and calloused by pain, and now they're a little kinder to people. My daughter has a very altruistic heart because she's watched me over the years. We affect people. So if you're new, you're going to hear a lot of stuff this weekend. I just hope you're sick enough of you and desperate enough to say to yourself, what do I got to lose? What do I got to lose here? I mean, I've ruined my life. Why don't I just put all my chips in this pot called Alcoholics Anonymous and let's see what happens. And if you can do that, you will see, even if you've been a relapser for 5 or 10 years, you will see a dramatic shift. And here's the shift. For years, I came around here and I tried not to drink and I always relapsed. In 1978, I started taking actions I didn't believe in. And unbeknownst to me, I had left a group that exists in Alcoholics Anonymous since the very beginning. The people that are in the rooms but dying of alcoholism. And it defines the line between the ones getting better and the ones dying by saying those who do not recover are people who cannot or will not completely, which is more than half, completely give themselves to this simple program. And if you're new here, I encourage you to be in the completely group and get a sponsor and do this deal. Thanks for listening. Wow.
No potty breaks while I'm talking.
Just kidding.
My name's Valerie, I'm an alcoholic.
Hey,
somebody might have to bring me a cup anyway. I drank coffee on the way. I apologize for being late. We hit a accident right before the tunnel, which is like the worst place to have an accident. So we just listened to funky music and embarrassed ourselves on the road, but we don't care. Thank you, Bob. I'm glad I got to hear most of that. I really enjoy listening to him. He's always has a unique way of putting words on my experience and every alcoholic's experience. I think about how we think and the feelings and the insane stuff that we do in describing that powerlessness and that unmanageability. The thing that I kept thinking about when he was talking was, it's so true, the problem of the alcoholic absolutely centers in my mind. And I had a defective mind before I ever picked up a drink of alcohol. There was something wrong with my perception and my thinking. And that's why alcohol made everything better for me. That's why alcohol worked and solved the problem. When I think about what happened to me, and I think about when he was talking about what Dr. Silkworth says in the doctor's opinion about how we were irritable, restless, and discontent. And that's me. That was me before I ever picked up a drink. I was irritable, restless, and discontent. Absolutely had that huge hole in my gut. Did not fit with the world. My thinking and perception of what was happening was very, I felt threatened a lot. I was very, very afraid, very standoffish from people. And my mind never stopped. You know, I was talking to somebody the other day, my mind has never been a playground, even when there was good porn going on. My mind has never been a playground. It's like a torture chamber up there, you know what I'm saying? It's not fun. It never has been, ever, ever. And that's why I loved alcohol, because that was the first time that my mind was quiet and the hole was gone. It was a terrifying thing for me when I sobered up and that big hole in my gut showed back up. It was terrifying to me because the pain of that. I was pretty much willing to do anything not to feel that way. So when I drank, I came into AA pretty young. I hadn't been drinking very long. But what happened to me when I had my first drunk, and I drank it quickly, like Bob was talking about, it was rum and Coke. What happened to me on that first drunk is my mind was suddenly quiet. I didn't care anymore. I was happy. I was comfortable with myself. I was finally comfortable with the people that I was with that normally I was very intimidated by. Desperately wanted to belong with these people, but always seemed to do and say the wrong thing. But when I got drunk, it was fine. I felt fine on the inside, and I seemed like I was getting along with people. The problem with me is I tend to overshoot the mark quite frequently. At one point in my drinking, I decided to keep a journal. So I figured if I could document the nights that I didn't mess it up, that that's the like secret formula that I would repeat over and over again. Unfortunately, you know, when you try to read that journal in the morning, it's not always, you know, clear. So anyway, journaling did not work. But so that experience, and it was like a spiritual experience for me. I had a psychic change with that drunk. And I really, it was so powerful for me. I really wanted to figure out, how do I feel this way all of the time? I want to live this way because I'm comfortable. And I pursued that with a vengeance right away. I'm not somebody who eased into my alcoholism. It progressed really quickly with me. And I was willing to do a lot in order to try to stay that way 24/7. And when you're 15, you're going to get into trouble. And you're going to go to juvie. And there's some prices that I had to pay in just my desperate attempt to try to live that way, to feel that way. And, you know, like Bob so eloquently talked about, it doesn't matter the consequence. I don't care about that. It's your fault I feel this way anyway. You know, I used to hear this guy, Keith Lewis, talk about, you know, we're masters at just blaming how I feel on my circumstances and how they're just not right. And the people in my circumstances are just not right. And I really did believe, and I went to an ACO meeting one time that just validated it for me, that my parents were the problem. Because I have alcoholism all over my family. But anyway, it was their fault that I was dysfunctional. And anyway, Keith Lewis was talking about, yeah, my mother had a square nipple. I'm like, that's it? My mother had a square nipple. But what he was saying is, it doesn't matter what it is. I mean, you put me on the potty seat backwards. That's why. I mean, it doesn't matter. You know? It's your fault. And I really believe that. That is my key delusion. Is that it's your fault. And it wasn't until I was sober well that even started to leave. But anyway, and all the stuff that comes from that, the entitlement and the, you know, blame and the, you need to fix this, you need to change. If you would change, I'd be okay. If my circumstances were different, I'd be okay. And, you know, for us, that doesn't seem to make a difference. Or it didn't for me. So I end up in a treatment center after drinking just for a year, and I was really upset because the therapist I was seeing at the time, I started seeing a lot of therapists, and people were trying to help me, you know. And I was really upset because I was smoking weed with that therapist, and I felt totally betrayed. Which I was. I still believe that to this day. I'm just kidding, kind of. Anyway. So he told my parents that I had an alcohol and drug problem and I needed to be put into a treatment center. And I didn't believe that for a minute, but I was grateful for the vacation. I loved being hospitalized. And that's my internal unmanageability. I loved being hospitalized. I liked the break. I liked the attention. I liked the drugs. I like the incessant talking about me. I liked it when people felt sorry for me. You also learn new and inventive ways to do things when you're locked up with people. Things that you haven't tried yet that make good sense. So I loved being hospitalized, mainly because it was a break. And even at that, for me, when I look back and I just look at all the internal unmanageability that was going on, even back then, life was overwhelming for me. It was too much for me to bear. I couldn't show up for the simplest thing. It was too difficult. So my experience with AA was, y'all, when I came in 1982, the first time when I was 15. I mean, to me, AA, what you guys were talking about was, I could not relate. And I looked on the outside, and it was all a bunch of old guys. And I, you know, they were the crusty team. And I did not understand what they were saying to me. You know, I didn't understand this, you know, keep coming back stuff. I didn't understand the consequences that they were talking about. I hadn't experienced that. I didn't understand that consequences are not the definition of my alcoholism, that that's not what defines my alcoholism. And I don't, one thing too that I'm really grateful for in AA is there, today there's a lot of talk about what it means to be powerless and the unmanageability. When I came in the early 80s, I mean, it was very therapy orientated, and the meetings were, and we talked a lot about feelings and putting the plug in the jug and all that other stuff. But there was stuff that was talked about. And your alcoholism was defined by your consequences. That's what I heard. That's how I heard it. You know, and you just go to a meeting every day, and you don't drink no matter what, even if your ass falls off. And if it falls off, then you just carry it to a meeting. And I'm like, you know, that sounds nice. But for someone like me, that I'll hold on to that. It sounds like a brave new world, you know, if I can make that happen. But when the insanity is on me, when I'm going to drink, I'm going to drink. I never picked up the phone and called somebody and said, I'm getting ready to drink, help me. Never, ever. That is not my experience at all. I don't even understand that experience. When Bob was talking about, you know, can I just have two? I mean, that just makes my butt cheeks get tight. I mean, I get so uncomfortable. I don't even understand the point of two. That makes me physically unwell. And I have unrest within with that. I only think alcoholics feel that way. I don't think non-alcoholics do. I don't think they even think that way. I don't even see the point in that. That makes me really uncomfortable. My last drunk was very similar to that, and it makes me think of that. And the absolute physical and sheer terror that I was in my last drunk. I can remember it today like it was yesterday. So I'm absolutely powerless. When I was younger, I had all kinds of ideas of why I'm not. And it was because of my family. It's because of how I was raised, the things that I had experienced. That's the problem. It's not that, you know, I'm physically and mentally different. And if, like all alcoholics, if I can just get it just right on the outside, if I can get away from these people, if I can go over here or go over there, it's going to be different. And I did that. And went in and out of AA for 10 years trying to do that, trying to be anything but an alcoholic. I did not want to be one of you people. And I certainly didn't want to do what y'all do. So my 10 years of going in and out of Alcoholics Anonymous was to try to prove to myself that I could be like other people. And I didn't need to do this thing. At one time I had about 3 years dry. My friend in North Carolina calls it sobriety. I was in AA and not drinking, but that was about it. And I, you know, and I'm really grateful for that experience because I know this is a spiritual malady. I know the main problem of the alcoholic centers in the mind rather than in my body. I mean, the body's not that great, but not a happy story there either. But But it really is the mind. It really is my spiritual condition. Because I was sitting in a meeting of AA, of A&A, every day. Had a sponsor. I didn't tell her the truth about anything. But I was in a meeting every day. Hanging out with the winners. What that means, you know, is I was actively engaged in working with others in the 13th step. That was my version of working with others, chasing tail in AA. So, but that was AA to me. I thought that was recovery. It was shocking to me to figure out that how it works was in the big book. I had no idea. I'm serious. All I knew is people get up and read how it works off a sheet of paper. I didn't know it was in our big book. So that was AA to me, sit in a meeting every day. And this, I remember this guy, Big Book Mac, he said to me one time, he goes, "Kid, you need to sit down, shut up, and keep your legs crossed because you're completely missing it." And I had no idea what he was talking about. I was like, "Ha, ha, ha, you funny old timer. Ha, ha. You're so cute. Let me rub your Buddha belly." Because he was a big guy. Let's go to the track, you know? I mean, so going to the horse tracks was a big deal out there. I used to go to the track all the time. Anyway, but that was AA to me. Was sitting, and I got very, very, very sick. Very, very sick. But I wasn't drinking. But eventually, you know, if we're living that way, even if we're going to a meeting every day, we got a sponsor. If that psychic change has not happened, I just don't have that effective mental defense against the drink. I am powerless over that. I will drink again, and there's nothing that will stop me. Nothing. You know, I work with a lot of women that are incarcerated, and, you know, gung-ho while we're locked up. And I'm, you know, I can't wait to get out. I'm going to make my amends. And they got all these consequences hanging over their head. You know, they get out there and get their kids back. If they violate, they're going right back to the clink, lose all their good time, all that stuff. Those are heavy-duty consequences. Heavy-duty consequences. Doesn't matter. If that psychic change hasn't happened within us, within me, I am absolutely doomed to drink. Because And I have no control over that. There's nothing I can do. I really identified with Bill Wilson when he talked about being hopelessly defeated, being cornered. Unfortunately, with somebody like me, it takes being cornered. Cornered, cornered, cornered. Before I will even begin to start to admit defeat. And thank God for a God that has some mercy on somebody like me. People like us, that we get those moments of truth and willingness and power to come back here and start to try to do this thing. That power certainly didn't come from within me. I'll tell you about my last drunk. So I was living up in New York and running around like a fool and drinking and living, you know, the ugly life that we do and a double life and all that stuff. And through a series of events, I experienced a bottom and I made a decision. When I moved down to Richmond, Virginia, I'm going to get sober. Like, I can make that happen. I can make that decision. And I'm going to show up at AA and I'm going to make it happen. I know what to do. It's like Bob was talking about knowledge. I know what to do. I know something about what we do here. I know what to do. I'm going to go to that meeting. I'm going to get sober and stay sober for the rest of my life. And I meant it. I meant it. Go down to Richmond, Virginia. I go to the Phoenix Group on Huguenot Road. which I thought was appropriate since I'm going to be a phoenix rising from the ashes. I am a narcissist, psychopath, ego-driven fool. And I go to that meeting and I humbly request sponsorship. Got a sponsor. Was going to a meeting every day. Felt like I was home. This is the place to be. And ended up drinking again with no effective mental defense. Had no idea it was coming. Go walk back to AA. Pick up another white chip. I'm really done this time. I mean it. I'm really done. Go up to Minnesota to see an artist. I was representing artists at the time. Sitting in the studio, and he just asked me, "Do you want a drink?" I said, "Yes, I do," just like that. So I get my little shot of whiskey in me, and of course, I'm like, "Can I have another one?" Get the second one in, and then my now ex-husband shows up, and I am pissed. And so is he, by the way, because I wasn't supposed to be drinking. But it's his fault I drink anyway. And why are you here? Go away. And the unbearable physical and mental torture, I totally identify with that in doctor's opinion. It's unbearable. It's a great word to describe it. It is unbearable. I felt like I was being torn in two. Split right down the middle. I was irritable, restless, and discontent. And I wanted another drink bad. Bad. And I was doing whatever I had to do to try to get another drink. And we were staying with his family. And I'm embarrassing him in front of his family because I'm picking a fight so I can get out. Get out anywhere. Trying to get upstairs. All I had was beer, which is, I'm not a beer drinker, I'm a liquor drinker, but I was willing to drink it. But I need anything. I want anything to shut this up, number one, and also to calm the physical uncomfortability that I'm experiencing. It is torture. So I wait for all of them to go to bed, and I sneak upstairs and start to drink. And it is sweet relief to be able to start drinking. And then something happened, though, that I can't control. I had no control over. I don't know where it came from. But within me came that prayer that I've prayed many times before, which was just, "God, help me." And that was my last drink. I don't know why. I don't know if that surrender was more complete. I don't know, and I don't care. All I know is that I got some power from that moment on to be all in, to drink the AA Kool-Aid. To the best I can, to the best of my ability on a daily basis, give myself, like Bob talked about, to this simple program, and do what's been asked of me. Sometimes without a fight, sometimes with a fight, but you know, start to suit up and show up and actually participate. And it was built on that absolute surrender and knowing I was beat, that there's no human power that can solve what's wrong with me. No human power. Not even the power I can bring to the table. The power that my ex-husband could bring to the table wasn't enough. My young son, not enough. My family, not enough. His family, not enough. Wanting to be a good person, good wife, not enough. I just don't have the power. I'm absolutely powerless. And I lost that power of choice a long time ago. And I love how the book describes it. We're like people who've lost their legs. You're never going to grow new ones. It's like if you got it, you got it. There's nothing you can do about it. I mean, you can't go in and do a little body cleanse and get that little gene out of there. You know, you can't scrub it out. I mean, if you got it, you got it. There's nothing you can do except die the alcoholic death or accept a spiritual answer. And I think that's why they spend so much time in our big book talking about the first step, to help us really identify, am I one of you? Am I you? Did I drink like how they talk about them, like I hear in meetings? Did I think that way? Did I feel that way? You know, that's part of the reason why I love hearing Bob talk, because I identify. I totally identify with that thinking. Gets me right there. I know the sound of that. And that's what we do when we talk to each other, when we're sharing our experience, strength, and hope. That's the only way you can get through my mind, is we start talking to the Spirit. You know, we're not talking to your mind. Your mind will, you know, bend you over and say, here it comes. You know? No lube for you. You know? I really promise myself that I'm not going to be crude every time I talk, and it happens anyway. But you know what I'm saying. It drives the point home, right? No pun intended. Sharing experience, strength, and hope, the message of depth and weight. If I don't know that I've gotten this thing, if I haven't conceded that I've gotten this thing because I identify, if I can't bring my experience to your experience, to what's written here, I am not going to do the rest of this stuff. Why would I? What's the point? I don't want to write any inventory and be entirely honest. I like my lying. I like my stealing. I really did enjoy being a thief. It was hard to give up. I really enjoyed it. I mean, just stuff like that. You know, a spiritual life, a principled life, a turned outward life. What an order. So, the willingness and the power to go live that way, to live our way, to live this way, comes from that. For me, it came from that conceding to my innermost self that I was alcoholic and that my life was unmanageable and I had nowhere else to go, that I was going to have to seek a spiritual solution. There was nothing else for me. And I tried everything. I even thought I tried AA, but I was wrong. But I tried therapy, drugs, religion. I've been saved numerous times. Went in an alcoholic, came out one too, you know? So, I've tried a lot of different things, getting married, having a baby, moving here, moving there, having money, not having money. Never solved the problem. But Alcoholics Anonymous and learning how to live this way and being willing to live this way solved the problem. I haven't had that huge hole in my gut for many, many, many years. Many years. And I'm really grateful for that. Thanks.
Thanks so much. Let's take care of a little business before we break. We're going to pass the seventh tradition basket. Every AA group ought to be fully self-supporting, climbing outside contributions. While contributions cover each group's rent and other expenses, the seventh tradition is essential at every level of AA service. It's both a privilege and a responsibility for groups and members to ensure that not only their group, but also their intergroup central office, local services, district area, and the general service office remain self-supporting. This keeps AA free of outside influences that might divert us from our primary purpose, to help the alcoholic who still suffers. The amount of our contribution is secondary to the spiritual connection that unites all groups around the world. And at the beginning of the meeting, we asked anyone in their first 30 days, as you go to break, if you're new, please speak to somebody. Just strike up a conversation. Just say, hey, your name. We'll talk back to you. We're really glad you're here tonight. And we're going to take about a 15-minute break. I do have one reminder. Smokers, please use the butt can provided outside and stay well away from the church doors. And let's take a 15-minute break. We'll start back here about 8 o'clock.